No, okay. Now again. Sorry? Ich kann das Licht vorne ausmachen. Das ist durchaus möglich. Huh? Huh? Very nice. Ja gut, passt schon. So this will contribute to dozing away probably, but anyway, if you want to see that, good. So starting from the beginning. So we've been talking about social games actually, right? And this is something that we are about to finish, right? We started off yesterday by trying to define what play and game really is, looked at some philosophical statements about that. Then we went over to discussing in how far you could, well, categorize games, okay? And in order to do so, I introduced you to a framework where we had some meta types of games that I'll repeat in a second and some types. And we were just interrupted while discussing these types. Okay. So the meta types that we had, and again, I have to emphasize that they're by no means considered to be the law or in other way obligatory or mandatory or, well, ensured scientific insights. However, considering the literature on ludology and considering our own empirical insights, we came up with these meta types. Okay, so simulation, social, online, and mobile, and as a subtype of mobile, we had location-based. Okay, so if you find more meta types, then please discuss. And we said that these meta types were intended as a framework, so a given type or genre and or genre of a game will have contributions in one or more of these meta types. So the meta types are considered to be, even in the classification, to be non-overlapping, okay, to be overlapping, okay? So, and then we looked at these meta types, characterized them, and then we went over to these actual types of games, okay? And in these types of games, we distinguished hardcore games, casual games, pervasive, and serious games, and then we discussed several of them, and among them is especially important casual, because casual has a primary meta type social, which is interesting for this lecture. And according to that, it is important for us. Okay. So, and in pervasive, that was about where we stopped. We said, okay, pervasive computing is about, well, attributing computing or processing power to elements of real life. So to the infrastructure, to the doors, to the presentation in environment and so on. And among that, pervasive games play an important role because they do what is our vision here, or at least my vision in the lecture, that the boundary between the actual cyber world, the game world, and the physical world will become increasingly blurred. Okay, and the guy that gave that definition here also stated the respective synonyms or almost synonyms for pervasive games. So immersive, because they, well, other games are also immersive, but immersive in a special way, because the immersion, the being integrated into the game environment, also covers the real life aspects. Locative games, pervasive games. So that's a collection of synonyms that kind of point to several of the aspects, and several of these aspects are still debatable. For example, as immersive, right? Because immersive is a category that is in a way orthogonal to pervasive, okay? Because pervasive games can be as immersive as hardcore games. However, what I would invite you to do is to consider these terms, think about them in turn, and think about which ones can you agree with respect to your definition of pervasive, okay? Good. And, well, we investigated some subtypes, right? So what is certainly in this class is anything that has to do with hardware and sensors, right? Because sensors already point to measuring context. And context is certainly something that is relevant for this transition from the cyber world to the physical world, right? Because in the physical world, the amount of context that's available is much richer in a certain way than in the game world itself, right? In the game world, you have the UI elements, joysticks, keyboards, and so on. They produce the input, and maybe you have things as location, maybe if you have that, and whatever, gender of the player, something like that, rough context elements. Whereas in the physical world, the context is very rich. Okay. So for example, we'll be talking about social situations in this lecture. And as I said, right now, we're having already a complex social situation, right? There's a lot of expectations from your side, maybe from my side. There's a seating order, there's an arrangement, there's distances, right? And it would be very disturbing if one party or the other party would break the treaties that are, well, implicitly valid in this social situation, right? For example, if I come nearer to you, you would say, what's Gro doing? And here already things become strange for you, and now they become really strange, right? And and that's only natural because we're having an intuition about distances and so on, right? And these things make up very rich context that we are trying to measure, that we're trying to use. And on the market, there are already several, little robots for childs. And it all started off with this very simple things, Tamagotchi and so on. I will elaborate more on effective computing later. Then I already told you about tabletop environments, right? And the respective MIT group, tangible computing, right? Things that you can touch with your fingers, manipulate, and that builds a context or input. And you know, there's a blurry differentiation between input and context that can be used in a game, right? For example, if you have a tabletop and you have real plastic pawns and a system that can register or measure the position of the respective playing figures, and then you can interact with that with the tabletop environment, okay? And in our group, we use tabletops a lot. So there has been work in creativity support by René a few 2 years ago, and now Nicholas works on collaborative music composition, right? Because that's also a socio-technical system, albeit with a more limited context in time and space, right? In a fictionist role-playing game, maybe people run around, whereas in that composition setting, they usually stand around these tabletop multi-touch displays. Geocaching I've been mentioning quite a lot. And then augmented reality games via head-mounted displays or projected images on real-world surfaces. Okay, good. Now, last type, is serious games. And that's another very hot topic, serious games and gamification. So what is a serious game in its core form? It's a game that has useful side effects. And those useful side effects can be in education, for example, learning new words in a foreign language, e-learning in general, edutainment, game-based learning, whatever. These are synonyms, related and overlapping terms that point to this education field. Okay, and it's clear what the useful side effect here is. Then training. So there is, for example, flight simulators that can be used in that fashion. Even military training, where we already see that even games can have an ethical side to them. And I would always advertise in this lecture, where we talk a lot about sensors and context and measuring human categories, that you strongly revise everything that you see with the point of view of ethics, okay? So as computer scientists, we're absolutely not out of this field, and we have to act responsibly in what we do, right? So this is just a neutral remark that I'll repeat a few times. Another thing is financial simulations or political games, healthcare games. And in that field, there's also a lot of activity at TUM. Professor Kretschmer does things in healthcare games. And we do, right? Gudrun Klinker does. And if you will get to the master's level, especially for the games engineering students, I would strongly advertise that might consider doing the master's games engineering lab course with topics like that. Okay, good. So, and this is maybe distinguished in a certain sense or subtyped by games with a purpose. Okay, so it's debatable whether serious games are a superset or just an overlapping set with games with a purpose. And I have, for those that are interested in that discussion, I can upload some chapters of a dissertation by François Brie at LMU. François Brie does also a lot of things in gamification, games with a purpose, and serious games. So for those that are interested in those topics, I can point you and introduce you there. Okay? So games with a purpose are games that have side effects that are not immediately useful for the users, but that are useful for somebody else. Okay? And we could, associate this with terms like human-based computation or crowdsourcing. But crowdsourcing is, again, a more general term that has its overlaps with games with a purpose, and designates just that you hire a number of workers, for example, with Amazon Mechanical Turk, that do little tasks for you, and via the sheer empirical number of those workers, you'll get a clearer picture, for example, about human behavior or estimations of some sort or other things, right? Where the number of participants will smooth out individual, biases and other things, right? And obviously, this is also a very interesting aspect for games with a purpose. However, crowdsourcing is more general, because that can just be paid work, okay? And to give you an example for games with a purpose, at Professor Brie's chair, there were guys that developed a platform that is called Artigo, and Artigo is about artworks, okay? So paintings mainly from all decades, and around that framework with the images, a lot of different games concepts were developed. And these can range from simple matching games, where two users have to forecast, tags about an artwork. And if these tags match, then the users will be awarded points. Okay? And this can be refined, right, in various ways, so that, for example, certain obvious tags are forbidden, Okay, so if you know, I don't know, Monet, Impressionism, you would find that if you have moonflowers on the respective meadows, this is a rather obvious tag. Or The Man with the Golden Helmet, I guess it's by Rubens, okay? So if the tags man, helmet, golden, they're nice, but they're not maybe what you would want. And I'll explain to you what we want in a second. So obvious tags can be excluded, and there are very many other variants of those games. For example, games where you exclude friends from playing with each other for the reason that you fear that they might agree via other channels while playing the game and so on. Okay? And what results in that is a so-called folksonomy, right? And the term stems from two sources, namely ontology or taxonomy, to be more precise, and folk in the sense of, wisdom of the crowd, folk knowledge. Many people contribute with their knowledge to generate something. And you know that from things like Wikipedia, that this is a very successful way of interacting and way of producing new knowledge. And a folksonomy is a set of triples, and each triple element is a tag, the user that tagged, and the respective object of the tag. Okay? And with those folksonomies, you can do a lot of things. There was a recent PhD thesis in our group by a researcher from Siemens that did a lot of data mining on these structures, and one of Professor Brie's group worked a lot with decomposing the resulting sets or tensors, three-dimensional matrices, into components. And then you can find, for example, trends and other subsets of interest. And these techniques are, for example, also used in biocomputing when analyzing, genome data, arrays, anything that has a large numerical output with various aspects, okay? And one thing that is interesting here is, for example, in art theory, where you know that, for example, Impressionism is described in art theory as, for example, geared towards color perception, foremost more important than perception of shapes. That's why they use pointillism. That's why they use all these soft contours and focus on nature and buildings and so on in order to, deal with color and mood, right? And there is art theory about almost all the genres and styles. And the question, one research question could be how people perceive that. Is it really true that people perceive color and mood in the first place? But is it something that is different, right? So this has its impacts in art reception and even, art education. And, that's a platform, and people play games, very simple games, and surprisingly so, people like to play these games, although they're so simple. And what comes out is this very interesting data set. Okay, and that's very typical for games with a purpose. And one other term that's very important here is gamification, right? That's very popular these days, and it designates the strategy of using game elements in non-game applications. For example, business applications that work with primitives such as scores, players, lives that you can lose, competition, and so on, right? That has a clear overlap with these concepts. And the associated meta types are clearly social and also simulation. And they're very interesting for us, naturally. Okay. Now, combining these two axes or aspects, so meta types and types, you could maybe come up with something like that. Okay. So what's the relation, for example, between hardcore games and the meta type simulation? Obviously, a lot of hardcore games, shooters, all these space things flying around simulate in some sense a part of reality. They use elaborate 3D graphics, simulating the 3D perception of our visual system. And they also use a lot of credible game physics to achieve their simulative, immersive effect. Okay? And, this is something that is clearly, can be clearly done. For example, as we told that pervasive and serious games should rather be maybe more social in that case, so I would maybe rather change that to at least such a half thing or even a three-quarter one, right? So I would also invite you to critically reflect on this table, on this matrix, and try to come up maybe with your own estimations, okay? Now, still, again, you might say, come on, Cole, why do you always say, we have to think about it, you're the teacher, right? Why don't you tell us how it is, okay? Now, the thing is, yeah, two answers. First answer, ludology is something that is still in the flow and things develop very fast, right? For example, your point yesterday was completely valid with respect to frustration, and it's just an observation that you have to critically discuss. So there is no canonical classification out there, at least none that would span or would be, well, a safe and set scientific insight. And the second thing, why I invite you to make up your own minds about these definitions and these matrices and types, is because activating is the best way of learning, right? People don't hear that or don't like that very well, because it makes it necessary that you do something, but it's the best way to kind of deal with these terms and definitions. Okay. If you just receive them and learn them and just say bang, 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 bang and spit them out in some exam, it's certainly not worth anything, right? These are just words, words in, words out. So do something, work with these things, and being critical is certainly a way to effectively deal with that, because here you have a statement. And you can say, would I really believe what Gro said? No. And that point, I don't agree. For example, the point with frustration. That's important, and that's always a style that I would invite you to deal with the issues here in the lecture. Set aside the math things, because math is somehow indisputable, right? Yeah? Yes. So the question was, why is the relation between online and hardcore so weak? Only 1 point out of 4. Okay. Because you say that most hardcore games have an online component. Okay. Now, that is, two answers. First, it's a weakness of the definition of online, right? Because even some ego shooters like Counter-Strike or something have a strong online component in that we have multiplayer interaction over the web, okay? But the core definition of online was that you require an ever ongoing connection and that it's mostly web-based in some sense. And that's a rather weak definition, admittedly, right? But I would say these games are not, from a conceptual level, not really targeted towards this online connection. It's like an add-on in a certain sense. Yeah. That would be debatable. So you could say, well, I would say that these days hardcore is always online. So I would give it at least 2 or even 3, right? There is nothing to really say against. That's just one possible argument to deal with. Okay, good. So let's go further in that direction. So then we had the meta types and the types. Now there is still something else that's called genre, and the distinction between type and genre is a rather subtle one. That is true for for paintings, for music, for literature. And you can find lengthy discussions on the web, what's the difference between a type and a genre. And again, it's rather, from my point of view, it's not totally set what the actual distinction is. I would say, I would give out the motto that a genre has a lot to do with the concrete content of a game, right? And this is how we're going to view that. And so the topical aspects, okay? And ludologists come up with a lot of different genre frameworks, right? And in that Jarvinen publication, there is a ludological genre framework that has been published. And one example published by, collectively published by those guys is that one here, right? So a genre distinction would be action, adventure, strategy, again, simulation, role-playing, puzzle, okay? So we see that it's not 100% distinctly different from our meta types. So there is an overlap between type and genre, and it's really extremely hard to separate both aspects. However, you would find that adventure is maybe a category that's more related to what is the actual content aspect. Yes, what is this about? Okay. And well, there are other frameworks, right, that go into that direction. So the critique is, again, these are not timeless frameworks. So as you can see from publication date, so this one goes back to 2003, and there has been an update in 2012. Now, this is already 3 years old, and you know how technology moves. You know how things like We and Connect come in, and these are all things that you have to constantly update. So the genre frameworks, as our typing and metatyping, is not timeless. And what we miss is formal criteria, right? In most cases, these publications discuss these criteria in text, right? And what they also have is that most of these genre frameworks are so-called taxonomies. And in the taxonomies, you'll have a tree, and the nodes are the genres, or the types, whatever you want. And the edges are often have semantics like subsumption, right? Subsumption means is a subclass of, okay? There's other edge types in that you might find in ontological, and that's an ontological framework. For example, part of relations are other ones that are in ontological frameworks, that occur in ontological frameworks. However, these relations are rather one way in that taxonomy style. So I would advocate more for a graph-like structure, because we see that it can be the case that you have circles, right? Although the circles are, from a mathematical point of view, if you would associate a subset relation, okay, you can never accept any cycles, right? So it can never be the case that A is a subset of B and B is a subset of C and C is a subset of A again. This, the only way that you can have that is that if A, B, and C are the same sets, okay? So but if you have other relations, for example, is strongly related to from a content point of view, or an edge type that says is strongly related with respect to game mechanics, or is strongly related with respect to the visual style, right? For example, wireframe-like primitive arcade-style games can have something in common, although type and genre are different, right? So I would advocate a more graph-like, type system here. And what's also a critique is that they're mostly driven from existing games. And, well, that's more like an empirical statistical point of view, whereas we would be much more in favor of something intentional, right? So extensional is something that follows empirical, statistical terms, right, counting and differentiating between instances, where intentional classifications would more focus on axes along which you can classify things as good, bad, or yes, no, or 0 to 1, something like that. Good. So, as I said, what would be better is a game classification based on game mechanics, and that's what people do, right? So a genre, or yeah, type slash genre. Genre is defined by a shared collection of core mechanisms. That's another statement by this ludologist. And, it's similar to the ludological genre frameworks, right? Or they're closely related. And a genre can then be defined as a set of game mechanics or an equivalence class. That's certainly something that makes sense, okay? And another pro of this is that if new styles of game mechanics arise, for example, if you make the transition to physical sensors, as in Kinect or Wii, you could add that easily to the existing system without substantially having to rewrite this, right? And then new genres are just new combinations of game mechanics, okay? Good. And what's often the case is that you have one witness in your equivalence class, and that's a concrete game, which you might call a pioneer game, which stands for the particular class of game mechanics, right? And this is certainly a good idea. Now, there's other attempts to really come up with a genre framework, and this guy that we have come across in previous slides gave 40, types of game mechanics, and so a genre would then be like a 4D vector that of, let's say, in 0-1, that would tell how much a certain game follows that type of game mechanics, okay, or game mechanics aspects. And these are just, in most cases, adjectives, right? So is the game about movement, acceleration, deceleration in a racing game, for example? Is it about aiming or shooting, right? Is it about enclosing, right? So designating equivalence classes of items, stuff like that, right? So this is maybe important in some types of serious games in that Artico framework, right? Placing, jumping, seeking, transforming, right? So transforming is something that, for example, is valid in a very successful serious game that's called Folded. Okay, who has heard of Folded? No one? So you know, proteins have complicated structures, right? So there's primary, secondary, tertiary, and even fourth order structures in the proteins that decide upon their biological function, right? So you have the sum formula. This is like the first level. What atoms are these molecules composed of? And then obviously, these atoms in the molecule structure interact, so that complicated spatial structures would be the result of that. Okay, and these complicated spatial structures then make the, for example, the enzyme or other highly complex protein molecules fulfill their role in the body or in any other biological system, okay? And it's very complicated to foresee from level n minus 1 how level n would look like, yeah? Because biomolecules consists of thousands of atoms, yeah, even tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, I don't know. And there's a game that's called Folded where people are asked to try to come up with a conformation or spatial configuration of a certain molecule. And if people, if a lot of people play that, crowdsourcing then ensures that the probability distribution of the actual folds that people produce is very in parallel to the probability distribution of real foldings, right? And these are interesting games, for example, where transformation is used, serious games and games with a purpose, however you want to call it. That's a game with a purpose, okay? Because it doesn't have a real focus for the user. Good. So one example for this pioneer game mechanics-oriented genre framework would be like, for example, if you have pioneer games like that, real-time strategy games, and then, well, this is a 0-1 classification where you just take out here game mechanics adjectives and say, are they fulfilled or not? A more fine-grained such classification would say, to which degree is each of those fulfilled, right? So that would be maybe more uniform. Here we have either 0 or 1, and these are the ones that have been designated as 1 fulfilled, like attacking, defending, building, conquering, information seeking, operating, point-to-point movement. This is game mechanics adjectives that characterize these pioneer games. Yes? Okay. Yes. 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 So the question was, how does it come that these adjectives characterizing game mechanics here are in most cases single player interaction based, right? Where is the social in there? Where's the interaction between players? Okay. Now we have that in some sense in buying, selling, or catching. So here it's maybe implicitly in there, but it's a critique that's absolutely valid. Okay. And this just shows us that we might need things like that, especially in those pervasive game styles where there's a blurring between virtual and real life. Because this is also something that's not very well featured in here. And I would just say, think about possibilities to expand that list in terms of interaction or where you would change that, okay? Because that's an ongoing issue, okay? But I think it's a valid critique. I can also, well, in some sense, it's orthogonal to that aspect you mentioned, because obviously people can transform together or can transform against each other, competing against each other, or they can buy and sell from each other, right? It's certainly in there, but in a way, well, you could think of more elements that would be more targeted towards real interaction between players. Good. Now, what's the summary so far? Okay. Good. So, what's a game? Okay. So, I took Frasca's definition from 2007. That, from my point of view, sums up all these different aspects in quite a reasonable fashion, right? An engaging activity in which players believe to have an active participation that points to this immersion and these real virtual worlds, and where they agree on a system of rules. We've been discussing rules and their aspects that assign social status to their quantified performance. So again, we said anything that's a quantified outcome of a game is often something that has a social flavor about it. Take, for example, the omnipresent points, right? Points are something that is, well, these are objects that are small, limited in time and space, and can be used for something in normally, like to appear in a list at a certain position. And you can already see the parallels in money, right? And exchange tokens. That's a typical social category. A point is something that is inherently social in its meaning. And all the other rewards and stuff are social, if you think about that. Because the great strength of humankind is not its individual intellectual abilities, right? A bonobo ape can do a lot of things that we can do, right? Some things even better. But surprisingly so, although these are already very social animals, we are the most social species on that planet. Because, for example, you can go to the bakery and give the lady a piece of metal and you'll get a roll, okay? That's surprisingly social because the lady can really rely on you to give her the piece of metal or paper instead of just killing her for the roll, right? It's already incredibly social. There's a lot of other species that would behave differently, right? So if you're a lion and you see, well, a small, nice, furry animal, your impulse is to say, nice, sweet. Yeah, so we don't do that. And it's the way our society is subtly differentiated is, yeah, remarkable from an outwardly perspective. Okay. So that's a definition by Frasca. Now, then we had four types of games: hardcore, casual, pervasive, and serious. And each one is described as a vector of meta types. We had these, in essence, four or five, however you want to do that, overlapping. And so you can describe in how far a casual is, for example, social. Okay. Then we said, okay, genres of games are either described via these ludological genre frameworks, which are more descriptive, text-oriented, or which is more intentional, described as subsets or vectors in a taxonomy or a list of game mechanics or game mechanics properties. That's how far we got, okay? Now, and there is other descriptive aspects of games and social games that come from different domains. Okay, so remember the first slide where we tried to come up with roles, for example, game designer, game developer, gamer, ludologist, that have different perspectives. And then we had these circles or these sets overlapping from various disciplines. And social was one interesting discipline which has to say a lot on games, socio-psychological domain. Okay, good. So, again, some citations. Okay, so dating back even to Plato and Ovid, right? So you can learn more about a person in an hour of play than in a year of conversation. Why? Obviously, because, well, in conversation, we're trying to, well, be tactical and strategical. We're trying to sell ourselves. Whereas in play, we transform something into that play world, see that simulative aspect. We adhere to those rules, and then we creatively use those rules in a playful manner. So in that new setting, we have in most cases not yet developed these typical tactical and strategical behaviors that we have in our normal social interaction. However, in MMOGs, there have been tactics and strategies that came up. One thing is, for example, gold farming, right? So you know that in games where you can sell or buy items like magical swords and stuff, there is people, especially in China, there is a large scene where people really make their living out of this. And in China, there has actually been a murder where a guy, a real murder, right, with a real knife, where a guy refused to sell the other one some magical sword in some online game. And then the guy went there and said, I hate you. And so this shows how these things can also be realized. But, well, nevertheless, there is this saying, okay? Ovid, in an hour of play, we reveal what kind of people we are in our play. The opposite of play isn't work, it's depression. And that's by Sutton Smith, which is a ludologist. Positive emotions we get from games are already spilling over into real. And, well, that's something that undermines what I, or supports what I've been putting out as a vision, that the boundary between the game world and the real world increasingly becomes blurred. Okay. Now, Numerous researchers address playing emotions that can be done from a psychological aspect, but it can also be done from a game mechanics aspect. For example, remember yesterday's discussion on frustration. Okay? So if you, well, creatively play with player frustration, this can contribute to really immersing the player into the game world. Whereas if you just constantly frustrate him or her, then you would just repel him. Okay? Good. And what's also interesting in that regard is motivation and flow, and in how far games support motivation and flow. So that is interesting from two perspectives. One perspective is if you're the game company and you want to sell a game, it's naturally the case that you would want to motivate players to really keep on playing your game. However, it's the contrary is also true. Okay, because with gamification, what you're trying to maximize is the actual flow in another field or the motivation in another field via constructions that stem from games. Okay, so you're using it in both ways. Good. So what we can distinguish is, as Yi tells us, is that we can distinguish three motivational components, okay? And that's one way to look at things in a more ludological way. So we have a game type or game genre, like massive multiplayer online games, and we have players, and we see several different motivational aspects in players, right? So achievement motivation, social motivation, and immersion, okay? And we see the connections to the stuff that we had before, right? So immersion is certainly something where we seek for entertainment, for a certain fun, even for this illings aspect of kalwa, right? So if our senses are stimulated by a game, by this, for example, by very LSD-like colors or so, I don't know, right? In immersion, there's even higher level goals, urge for discovery, well, escapism. I just want to have the game as a second reality that I can dive in, be there, and then dive out. And this can, for example, if you look at TV consumption, and TV used to be the escapist device of the 1970s and 80s, right? Sit before the flat screen, forget about your sorrows. Now, what people nowadays do is, or I know many people that have switched from TV to watching HBO series, right? So every one of you has a hard disk where Game of Thrones and all these things are on, and you distribute them, and these are very popular. Oh, I've been sick. I've been watching Game of Thrones all four seasons in 2 days. And now I'm really a bit crazy about dwarves and Jon Snow and whatever these guys are called, right? And the reason is people, in contrast to movies, which only last 1.5 hours, the series would be able to, well, fascinate you over a longer period. Good. Achievement motivation is something that is even more deeply rooted in motivational research in psychology, because in psychology, there is also a distinction between achievement-motivated persons that have a more social motivations. And in psychology, the third category is power motivation. Okay, so achievement motivation is about you making progress, whereas social, it is about you being connected to others, whereas in power motivation, it's you being better than the others, this more competitive motive. Okay, but this is more like a games-oriented motivational component theory. Well, there's other views on these things that stem much more from core psychology. And one thing is Maslow's basic need hierarchy or need pyramid. And as you can see in the pyramid itself, it has several layers. And the goal of this pyramid is to describe what motivates you in life. So the most basic layer in the pyramid is physiological. So physiological safety and physiological fulfillment of needs is a basic motivation. If I approach you and choke you and you don't get enough air, then this is very uncomfortable. You have a strong motivation to fight me to get back to a state of breathing. It's the same with water and nutrition, right? So if you're physiologically safe, right, then the next level is bodily safety, right? So you have enough things to eat, you can breathe, you can drink, but if I approach you with a sword, then you have the strong motivation to again fight me off because you want to feel safe. You want to have a place that you can lock where other people cannot get in. Next level, belonging, love, social relations, yeah, which covers everything from friendship to, erotic partnership and so on, which is also connected to basic needs and produces motivational components, right? So people go out at weekends because of that belonging love level in Maslow's need hierarchy, right? It covers also drinking beer with friends, right? It's not only about men and women and whatever other constellations that are. Well, and then there is self-esteem. So it's about you being able to fulfill a role in society. It's about you being able to do a certain variety of things. So you want to learn a profession. All of you are doing a course of study, right? And this has to do with building up self-esteem. I want to have a role, a niche in society where I can prosper, okay? And this prospering then is actually at the last or highest level self-actualization. And Selbstverwirklichung in German, right? So the difference is that in self-actualization, you already have your position, you have self-esteem, but you want to, well, actualize yourself. So that's why, for example, a lot of successful musicians then start to paint or sculpt or whatever other things people do. Madonna has become a feminist activist and so on. And that is not only about self-esteem, it's about self-actualization. And, well, what does that have to do with games? A lot of motivational aspects to play games are situated on the self-esteem level and also on the belonging love level, especially in social games, okay? Maybe somehow also in the self-actualization, but rather here, right? It's because of the, hardcore gamers, for example, want to be entertained, but it's also about you having and developing the skills in the game. That has a lot to do with building up self-esteem. So self-esteem is not only in those serious fields like profession and what sports or so, it can also be in games and play, right? Where you can draw self-esteem, and that's very important. And we need to understand that in order to take people seriously, because we see that being part of a guild or something can be serious for them because it has to do with their basic Maslow needs. Okay. A very general distinction, which is also, public domain knowledge, is intrinsic motivation versus extrinsic motivation. I mean, that is something that every one of you would know, I assume, right? Good. Then, there's other typologies for motivation, and this guy, Reis, came up with 16 different motives for motivation. And these are not necessarily motivation types, but again, it's more like a list of terms that can either be true for a certain motivational setting or not, okay? What we see here is this power motivation that I already explained, but also other motives such as curiosity, romance, whatever, right? And there's other things that are rather strange here from my point of view, like eating, which point more to a Maslow basic level. However, you can come up with your own extension here. Okay, these are independent motives that can be found and reasoned about, and you can already see the relations, for example, to Maslow. Okay, and then Radov came up with this player motivation diagram, and this has two axes. Okay, so here on the x-axis we see the number of players, and on the y-axis we differentiate between rather intrinsic motivation and rather extrinsic motivation, or as he calls it, qualitative or quantitative motivation. And we basically see four different types. Okay, so if the number of players is low and you're more geared towards intrinsic motivation, what results is immersion, right? So you and the game. Whereas, for example, if you're more, still a low number of players, but a more extrinsic motivation, it's about achievement. So if it's more about points and being better, getting more levels done and so on, well, single player game is the most predominant interaction schema, then you're more into achievement. And if intrinsic motivation is the case and you have several players, then you may be interested in cooperative games, right? So games like we build something, we raise something together, we develop a world, right? And things, Second Life, for example, was a kind of a game, a simulation, which was, in a sense, very cooperative. People would follow their own goals, develop their own clothing and stuff, what people did back then. I think it's about 5, 6, 7 years ago that Second Life was very popular, and building their own houses and things, but still inviting other people to also join in. And that's, in a sense, an indirect cooperation. Whereas the more extrinsic side to multiplayer then is competition. Another important thing is rewards, okay? So rewards are clearly a means to steer and guide motivation. Well, how many points are you going to reward for a certain action? Is it always about points, right? And the reward thing immediately comes in all types of social software as well, right? So you can analyze what is the reward of experts to answer questions in Stack Overflow. And it's clearly a reputation issue, right? What's the reward of people that contribute to open source projects? These are manifest business and profession rewards. If you're considered a Linux expert, then people might hire you for, if you're whatever, a server company or so, right? And in games, it's also the case. And one interesting field that I had contact with is knowledge management, right? So in knowledge management, the goal is to formalize knowledge of people in a company, for example, and make it accessible to others in the form of wikis, ontologies, taxonomies, semantic web structures, and so on. And a clearly interesting question is, why should people want to do that? If you're a Siemens engineer and you have very detailed knowledge about electronics in medical systems, what would make you explicate that knowledge in texts or wikis? What's the reward? And you could say, well, if your boss tells you, then this is clearly an extrinsic motivation. But I've been long running a few years ago the Munich Knowledge Management Circle, and one invited researcher came up with a very good idea. And she said, rewards, yeah, you need rewards. Maybe we should give the employees a nice bottle of wine. And everybody said, it's not going to work like this. Okay. So rewards and motivations need to be coupled in a more intelligent way, right? And that's also true for games, right? And forms of rewards are score system, experience points, item granting, feedback messages, unlocking mechanisms, and so on, right? And again, what we find is that very many of these reward systems are social in their nature, directly or indirectly. So Huang and Sun came up with four characteristics, right? So there is a social value of the reward. It should have an effect on the gameplay. It should be suitable for collection and review. And that is corresponding with our trend to hoard things and to collect, because that's our nature. If you look through your whatever IKEA bookshelf, you will find a lot of items in them, and they're there because they're there, right? Someone gave it to you, you kept it without having a need for it. So at least I'm a person that has a lot of items of all suitable sorts. I'm not a messy, but I have a lot of items, and maybe you have stuff too, right? So it's our nature to collect in a way. And another characteristic is the time required to earn or receive the reward. That points to the question how tactical and strategically you're going to deal out these rewards. If you're too quick with that, people get bored, right? Rewards can be used for game progress, for advancement, for review in the sense of what have I accomplished? And you see the connection to the motivational types, for sociality, for the interaction, and for cooperation and competition, right? So this is one perspective that further, feathers these things out, okay? Good. So that was on rewards and motivation. Now, what has been implicitly a component of all of this is naturally emotions, okay? And again, what we want is we want to elaborate on socio-psychological domain generated views on games. And emotions are clearly very important. Now, you might say, well, emotions are something that's not very accessible to computer science. And that's not true, right? So there has been efforts in trying to measure and sense and use emotions in IT systems that date back even to the mid-1990s. So Rosalind Picard is an electrical engineer, and she used to work at MIT Media Lab and led the group of effective computing, even back in the early 1990s. And what they did, they used sensors to measure bodily parameters, like the size of your pupils, the electric skin conductance and others, and your movements. Are your movements confident, right? For example, people that give lectures, do they give lectures like this, or rather in that orang-utan style? Depends, yeah? So it tells you a lot about their emotional background that they face during giving the lecture. And this is nowadays a part of social signal processing, right? Social signal processing is the discipline that deals with using machine learning and data mining techniques on sensor data towards measuring socially relevant phenomena. And emotions are among them. It even goes further into emotion synthesis. For example, if you work in the field, in the field of human-like robots that interact, for example, with elderly, what you need is a credible, not only a credible analysis, but also a credible synthesis. So the robot must be able to explain a real smile and not something like this. Now, this is not real. Why? Because my eyes and my eyebrows didn't consistently move with my mouth. That's a typical false smile. If you want to create a false smile, just move your mouth and leave your upper eye region as it is, right? So this is also about this. And one of my students that currently works on his master thesis works on a system for emotion synthesis for non-player characters, right? So how can we synthesize credible series of emotions and especially credible emotion interactions, right? If you come into a scene of a adventure game with great joy, and then there is another player that hits you square in the face, what will happen? Are you going to be angry? Are you going to be sad? Maybe both. Depends on the other player and depends on his emotional state and depends on the consequences. So depends on a lot of things. Yeah. Good. So there are several systems for characterizing emotions. So the most well-known is Ekman's six-dimensional emotion characterization system. And these are the six key or basis emotions: frustration, fear, surprise, sadness, and amusement. Right? Yes? These are five? Okay, one, two, three, four, five. That's great. Yes, these are five. So I will rectify this, right? So I could be the case that anger is one of them and it should be a comma instead of a bracket. Okay? But a good point, I will look that up. These are five. That's maybe why they're called six emotions, because they would rise curiosity. Why they're only five? I don't know. Good. So my mistake. Yeah. However, there are actually six, and I'm pretty sure that there are six and not five, right? So this is correct. Someone made an error, probably me. Good. Good. So this is this system, and each emotion that exists out there is intended to be a linear combination of these six basis emotions. And as you can already guess, there are some emotions that are less put into that framework. So there's others like Plutchik's Wheel of Emotions. I can show you Plutchik's Wheel of Emotions here in more detail. And this one has eight basis emotions already. And these are ecstasy, admiration, terror, amazement, grief, loathing, rage, vigilance, stuff like this. And they would have each of those has certain levels of intensity, and the levels of intensity are radially outward, right? And they are encoded here by the color intensity, right? So for example, if you take the yellow thing, so the most saturated yellow is about ecstasy, whereas the less saturated levels of yellow would then go out into more mild versions of that, such as serenity, okay? And this is in the radial direction. The color coding itself may remind you of color systems in art that you know from school. Every one of us had to kind of paint color systems like that in the fifth or sixth grades. And there are complementary colors, right? So one complementary pair could be like the pink and grass green, loathing and admiration, right? This is like the opposite emotion of that, or ecstasy and grief, right? And you can, well, debate whether rage and terror are really the opposites of one another, right? So this already shows you that it's the attempt to model a complicated psychological phenomenon into something like a vector system, right? But at least it is a system. And I remember talking to a psychologist at a conference, and at that time it was our goal to come up with a taxonomy of social relations. Yeah. So you all know that there's a lot of different social relations: friendship, love, affair, mother, sister, cousin, all kinds of types of social relations. And we wanted to have an ontology, a taxonomy for that. That's a side of that. And I asked her, is there something in your science where you would say this is an this is a fundamental ontology that is somewhere in a book? And she said, oh my God, that's such a stupid idea that only a computer scientist could come up with. Why do you want to press something as complicated as human social relations into something like a taxonomy? Are you mad? There's thick books I can recommend you. And then I said to her, well, very well. I see that we're trying to model something complicated into something simple, but in the end, I need to process numbers on a computer, right? On a computer, there is no such thing as maybe, or you can model maybe, yes, but you have to model it and you have to start somewhere. And the statement that something is not perfect is at least better than not having it, right? And maybe you could come up with a better classification. However, as we can see, since these are four basic axes, you can describe any emotion here, for example, with a vector, with a four vector between minus one and one. Yeah? And that's what we're trying to do in that master thesis, for example. As I said, how are emotions detected in social signal processing? So galvanic skin response, cardiovascular parameters such as pulse rate or blood pressure are clear indicators of certain emotions. Okay? So if I'm totally serene and relaxed, my pulse rate will be lower than if I'm agitated and angry, obviously. There are even attempts to measure brain activities with CAPS, right? And then there is, well, you can buy these things readily, like EEG, EMG CAPS that have sensors and deliver you a rough context of your brain activity. And you can also use computer vision or audio-based methods, right? A colleague of mine that just resumed a professorship at Uni Passau, Björn Schuller, is a very renowned expert in audio-based emotion detection. Good. So, Lazzaro pointed out five functions of player emotion in games, right? So, support the enjoyment, focus the attention, help in decision making, affect the performance, and support learning. Well, this again, as you can see, is a list that is somehow a bit ad hoc. And that's very typical of these ludological results because, well, that's a discipline that needs development. However, these things are certainly true in a sense, but maybe not complete. So you can maybe come up with additions here. Good. So, forms of engagements, okay? If you want to quantify how immersed or engaged a player is, there is some researchers that propose levels of intensity, ranging from involvement over presence to immersion, and last and most severe form of engagement is flow, right? So involvement is clear, right? If you're just somehow involved, as the word says, in the game, presence is already the perceptual illusion of non-mediation, meaning that you have the impression that you are already part of something without perceiving the mediating elements. So the mediating elements are mostly user interface elements, right? So if the joystick becomes part of your hand, then you are somehow present in the game. Immersion is one step further. So you not only in the game, and you don't perceive the mediating boundaries, but you're perceiving this as reality. So you have the illusion that something that you experience really is true at that moment in time. And in a sense, the most the most advanced form is flow. And flow as this famous definition here says, is the holistic sensation that is felt when they act with total involvement. Well, that's a bit self-reflecting definition, right? Want to try to define levels of involvement and say, well, maximum involvement is flow. Okay. But we will see more about flow in the next slides. However, it's a holistic sensation of really sucked up, being sucked up into something. So, forms of flow. Good. What are characteristics, right? So, who has ever experienced flow? Good. Silly question. Every one of us has hopefully experienced flow. Yeah. It's hard to experience flow and it doesn't happen very often. And these things are, from my point of view, the critical factors of success in life in a certain way. It's not so much about intelligence, right? Because intelligence is normally distributed and most of you will be well above 100. But it doesn't really make a super huge difference if you have an IQ of 110 or 120. What makes a difference is your ability to concentrate, for example, your ability to adapt to a certain situation, right? People that have difficulties with flow and adaption would never come to the point where they would concern themselves for like 3 to 4 hours with something. Yeah. For example, like DS exercise. Okay. People that have motivational difficulties will take up the exercise sheet, say, God damn, I'd never be able to solve this, and lay it away. Whether more flow oriented persons would say, I'll try. And while they're trying, they're networking their knowledge. Okay. And there has been a few weeks ago, there has been an article in Der Spiegel, which the headline was Concentrate, and this article elaborates on why this is such an important success factor, right? So the characteristics, intense and focused concentration, merging of action and awareness, so it all becomes one continuum, right? So you're not perceiving action, result, being aware of the result, making the next action as something that is distinguished, but it's more like one integrated thing. You lose your parts of your reflective self-consciousness. You're really totally immersed in something and you don't reflect upon you being an actor in that situation. You just act, okay? You have total control of your actions. If you just have to negotiate with yourself, how are you going to do this? You're not in flow. Flow is about total control. You have this distortion of time, temporal sensation, temporal measuring, right? So periods become enlarged or even more typically become very much shorter. So how long have you been playing? Oh, damn, it's 4 hours. And I perceive that as half an hour, right? And what's very important is that the activity is experienced as intrinsically rewarding. It's not someone told you to do that and then you'll get into the flow. That's not the case. Intrinsic motivation is necessary, right? Conditions for flow, right? Characteristics are easy, yeah? Conditions are hard. Because if you knew the conditions, the next step would be stimulate flow. And if we knew how to do that, we would boost the productivity of a society by a factor of, well, N, where N is very large, okay? So what is really important is that the challenges are placed at an appropriate level. So just at the boundary of overmatching and underutilizing, right? Either one doesn't lead to real flow. And appropriate with respect to the skills and capacities of the respective person, naturally. Okay, because that's clear. You must have clear proximate goals. If goals and rewards are too far in the future, you would never get into flow. And this corresponds to you have to give immediate feedback as a control system parameter. So these are three diagrams that characterize flow. Okay, let's look at the leftmost first, right? So we have two axes. The x-axis is about your skills, so your action capabilities, and the y-axis is about action opportunities, so about the challenges, okay? And we see that flow just occurs along the line where both things are balanced, right? Challenges and skills need to be balanced. If you're over-challenged, right, this will make you anxious. Oh my God, I can't do that. If you're under-challenged, with respect or relative to your skills always, then you're bored. So this is a very simple diagram. And in the middle diagram, one more category comes up, okay, which differentiates between how far you're on that x is equal to y axis, right? The first segment dividing axis, right? So if your skills are high and your challenge is high, then you're getting into flow. If your skills are low and the challenge is low, you would not get into flow, but rather into apathy. Like, I don't know. Well, I don't have to do it, but I can't do it anyway. I don't know. Yeah, something like that. Okay. And in the rightmost diagram, which is, well, the latest version, if you wish, there is already eight of these variations, right? We have again flow, where skills and challenges are high. And if skills are medium and challenges are high, you're not already in anxiety, you're just aroused, okay? So that's the typical setting for an exam, yeah? So your skills are medium, the challenges are high. You're not totally in that, oh, I will fail mode, but you would try your best, but you're kind of aroused, right? And apathy is also here. If the challenges are medium and the skills are medium, you would be in some sort of step of or some state of worry and so on, right? Boredom, relaxation, control, flow. I think that's the best version of that. Okay. Yes. Sure. Sure, it does. So the question was, does diagram A contradict B and C? Yes, the answer, it does contradict. But I would, well, with a more generous view, you might say that B and C are further developments, right? Not really contradicting, or A is not really, really contradicting intentionally. Good. Yes. Good. So we might take 5 more minutes since we started 5 minutes late, and maybe we can go through that slide set today. So another sociopsychological dimension is fun. Obviously, fun is something that would be listed among the most important motivational factors for games. But is there subtypes of fun somehow, right? And yes, as part of this mechanics, aesthetics, what's the D stand for? Forgot it. Framework of Hunicke, it's certainly an element here. And we have these types of fun. Okay, so there is, fantasy fun, narrative fun, challenge fun, all with their own characteristics. Okay, and again, we are having something that is about social pleasure, right? And, well, what does that tell us? So if we want to design games or socio-technical systems, we might want to make clear which kind of fun we want to evoke in our audience, okay? Don't know if that's of such a great value, but if you take that as a creative input, as a keyword, for example, in a brainstorming session or so, you might get to new solutions, right? Good. Okay, good. Shall we start with that? No, we're not going to start with that. So in order to wrap up today's session, right? There are a few more slides left with respect to, theory of games. Next slide set will be about social media. And the story then will be, is there a parallel between social media and social games? The outcome will be yes, which will justify that we would treat both on an equal footing with respect to social network analysis and the other things. We will finish that next time. And that's that. And so see you next Tuesday, right? At 3 p.m. See you then.